KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning. Coming up on Forum, we're going to hear from KQED's John Myers, who is in St. Paul at the Republican National Convention. And then we focus on the California state budget impasse as we find out who is being hurt by bills not being paid. Forum is next with your calls and emails right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Well, the California state budget is 66 days overdue, and that's the tardiest budget in the state's history. We're going to look at what programs and services are being hurt by this long budget impasse in the hour ahead. But first, we're going to go to St. Paul and talk with John Myers, as has been our custom here every morning, who is covering the Republican National Convention for us. He's our Sacramento Bureau Chief and joins us by phone. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Michael.
Well, I guess it's safe to say it was all about Sarah Palin last night, the vice presidential nominee, and even those who are critical of her politics are acknowledging it was quite a stellar performance. It was electrifying, and she certainly had the crowd, it seemed, in the palm of her hand.
Yeah, she did. I was on the floor for the speech about 40 yards away from the podium. It was the loudest and it was the most boisterous they've been. I think in some ways it was almost like this convention finally showed up. I think up until now, it's really been the tamest of the three national conventions that I've attended. And so she really electrified the crowd, as you said. And I think the speech clearly was designed for her, you know, to show not only that she, you know, could make the case for why McCain should be president, but to show that she has some sharp elbows. And she's not going to hesitate to throw them around. And they really did eat it up. I mean, you know, we use that cliche of throwing red meat out to the lions, you know, a lot of times, but it was true. They really, really liked what she had to say.
Well, it wasn't only elbows and red meat. It was, look, I'm a pit bull. She used that line about what's a hockey mother? A hockey mother is a pit bull with lipstick.
And it was an ad-lib. Yeah, it was an ad-lib.
Was it really? Yeah.
There was an ad-lib, and the delegates, I'm sure it was a planned ad-lib, which I guess defeats the purpose of being an ad-lib. But, you know, the delegates from California I was riding back with on the bus, that was their favorite line, just like, you know, a lot of folks at home. They loved it. They thought she was, you know, incredible. And I'll tell you, you know, the thing that the crowd really relished last night was their chance to point fingers at the media. You know, that has been the common theme about the Palin story for the last few days. And that passage in Governor Palin's speech where she jabbed at the media, one of the passages, the convention goers all turned around and they pointed at the news organization booth that ring the center and they booed. And, I mean, it was
weren't intense. They shouting NBC, in fact, a lot of them?
What's that?
A lot of them were shouting NBC, specifically, targeting NBC.
I couldn't tell
NBC.
That from where I was, but but they weren't just pointing at NBC. I watched them point around the entire ring. And so, I mean, I think they feel as though they have been, you know, overly scrutinized too much to that point. And so that's a very common theme.
That's the ghost of Spiro. The ghost of Spiro Agnew coming back or something.
Yeah, but it's a common theme from delegates from everywhere. And delegates from California have felt the same way. They've told me that, too. They think she's gotten an unfair shake.
She also, though, what was the I mean, she certainly wanted to present herself as a small-town gal with middle-class values and a PTA mom and all that, as well as an experienced hand. I mean, all that stuff about came from Giuliani as well about Obama being a community organizer. The crowd seemed to love that.
Yeah, they really did, because I think they feel like it was their first chance to really kind of, you know, rebut some of the Obama machine, you know, train, the express that came out of Denver last week. And I think that, you know, they enjoyed that, and she enjoyed being able to say that my experience does count for something. You know, so it was a very fascinating speech, and I think that in the way that some Democrats feel about Obama, I'm starting to see some of these Republicans feel that way about Sarah Palin, and I think they think that she has re-energized this race. She was a controversial pick, but she has absolutely changed the dynamic with the Republicans that I've been talking to over the last few days.
Isn't there a danger and concern maybe that she'll overshadow McCain?
I think that's entirely possible. I mean, I would tell you that the loudest the convention center got last night was when John McCain did his planned surprise appearance on stage after her speech. But yeah, I think the bar is high for McCain tonight to, you know, to really completely close the deal. But a lot of these folks, you know, I've got to tell you, especially like California is a great example. The delegates are all really diehard McCain people. The way they pick their delegates, these were people who were with McCain through thick and thin. And as a result, I think you've got a lot of people who really are going to lift him up, you know, even if his speech isn't quite as huge as Sarah Palin's.
There's been some criticism of the fact that a lot of the Republicans have been saying family's off limits, even though Barack Obama said that as far as Sarah Palin's concerned. But I mean, with a pregnant daughter and those kinds of concerns. But she really paraded her family out there yesterday. And some are saying, where was the family values in that with the boyfriend and the pregnant daughter and so forth? Did you hear any murmurs from the crowd on that?
I did not. I think this crowd thinks that, you know, what they were doing is this was a proactive, you know, stance on the issue rather than a reactive one. You know, to go ahead and bring it out and admit it. And right, they flew the boyfriend in from Alaska just yesterday, and he showed up in the seats with the family during the speech, and then out on the stage afterwards. I think they think they're putting out there, you know, hey, this is what it is, and we've accepted it, and we're dealing with it, and that's the message they're trying to pull out of St. Paul once this is all over, I think.
You were talking before about red meat. Rudy Giuliani did some red meeting too, so to speak, didn't he?
Yeah, I think he, you know, he made a very forceful case for why Barack Obama shouldn't be the next president. And, you know, the convention hall clearly had been tipped off about the kind of things they were going to do to symbolize things through the night, like they often are at these conventions. And their favorite one last night was taking a hand and, you know, rolling their fingers down into the sign of a zero or an O. And I think, you know, they enjoyed using that both ways, an O for Obama and a zero for what they claim he's done legislatively since he's been in office in the Senate. And the Giuliani speech was really classic of that, where they really jumped on board that theme.
Well, actually, Sarah Palin even pointed out that he hadn't authored any legislation in the state Senate of Illinois, which I don't believe is certainly not true in the U.S. Senate. He co-authored some legislation on ethics and a couple of things. But what about Huckabee's speech? What was the response you felt from Huckabee?
Well, you know, I'll just tell you first my own observation. I thought Huckabee's speech before Palin's speech, because it had that one, you know, really captured the attention of everyone. But the Huckabee speech, I think, frankly, was probably the best speech of the night in the terms of making a forceful but measured, for lack of a better term, attack on Democrats and why John McCain should be president. You know, there was a lot of positive imagery in the Huckabee speech, and it wasn't quite as attack-oriented. And the crowd really liked it. I mean, Huckabee is a favorite of the conservative movement of the Republican Party, and a lot of people, you know, clearly think he'll be back. And I think his self-deprecating humor at the beginning of saying, you know, well, John McCain's my second choice for president. You know, he's not afraid to continue to say that. But he was received very warmly. But, you know, the night really kind of ramped up from Huckabee on. Mitt Romney's speech appeared to be probably the most lukewarmly received, I guess, of the evening.
Well, they were all just warm-ups for Sarah Palin, as it turned out.
Yeah, and let's not forget, too, that Sarah Palin took her nice little jab where folks from San Francisco heard their names mentioned. I mean, she was talking about the fundraiser that Obama went to where he said the infamous line about people clinging to guns and religion. But anytime at a Republican convention you mention San Francisco, you're going to get the reaction you expect. So.
Well, what she said was he says one thing in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and then he says another thing in San Francisco. But we're talking to John Myers, who is with us from St. Paul, who's been covering the convention, the Republican National Convention for KQED. He's Sacramento Bureau Chief. And speaking of Sacramento, we're going to talk this hour about the effect of the budget. What do you hear from the delegates, and what do you got on your pipeline there, John?
Well, you know, these delegates seem, you know, it's really interesting, Michael. I have found among the California Republicans here in St. Paul, I have found almost unanimous support for what legislative Republicans are proposing to deal with this budget impasse. And very little support. I don't want to say zero because I'm sure there's someone, but very, very little support for Governor Schwarzenegger's plan of a sales tax increase combined with some cuts. I mean, two prominent people who have spoken to reporters over the week have said it. Governor Wilson told us on Monday he didn't like the sales tax idea. And then I spoke with Steve Poizner, the insurance commissioner who may be running for governor in 2010, and he doesn't like the tax increase idea. And, you know, it is interesting to see this kind of solidarity with that position. I wonder what Governor Schwarzenegger's reception with his own Republicans would have been like had he actually shown up to the convention. So these folks seem completely fine with letting this go forward and standing on principle at this point.
Well, we're going to go forward and talk about the budget. John, appreciate very much again your joining us this morning and your fine coverage for us in St. Paul. Thank you again.
Thank you.
That's John Myers, KQED Sacramento Bureau Chief, who is at St. Paul's National Republican Convention in St. Paul, Minnesota. We're going to go now to Sacramento and have Jean Ross on with us. She's Executive Director of the California Budget Project. And we really want to find out just really who's been stung with John Cheng, the controller, saying that bills are not going to be paid. And indeed, we're finding out that a lot of bills aren't being paid. Good morning, Jean.
Good morning.
Well, where do we stand in terms of who's getting hurt by this budget impasse?
Many of the nonprofit service providers, healthcare providers, businesses that sell things as mundane as jackets to the highway patrol we're reading about in the press, food for the prisoners in state correctional institutions, can't be paid without a signed state budget in place. Controller Cheng has said that about $12 billion in payments will not be made if the budget stalemate lasts through the month of September. Already for August and September, which are sort of slow months in terms of this, when payments go out the door for the state, about $4.5 billion of bills are overdue.
Well, that's should be certainly of great concern to the citizens of the state of California. I mean, what are we looking at here down the line? We're looking at bills that are going to continue to simply mount up and not be paid, are we not?
Until the budget is passed by the legislature, signed into law by the governor, those bills will mount up. It will take a very real toll, particularly on some of the true small businesses, small nonprofits. We've been reading about child care centers, child care programs in Fresno, for example, closing their doors because that's such a low margin business to begin with, that many of the individuals who do that just can't afford to keep taking care of kids if they're not getting paid through the public programs who provide the majority of the income for those businesses. So, yes, it does have a very real impact on Californians across the state.
Talking with Jean Ross, who is Executive Director of the California Budget Project, and the fact is, of course, that more people in this verge on recession economy are seeking help from government, and the counties are getting less money, and we're in this impasse because of the requirement of a two-thirds vote. What do you think about what Dan Walters said the other day, that you know this is a game of political chicken, and he thinks probably the Republicans will come out the winners?
It's tough because people do get to vote their conscience once they are sent here. We are a state with a strong Democratic majority in the legislature. However, two Republican votes are needed in the state Senate, six, and this year potentially seven because of a very ill Democratic Assembly member. Votes are needed in the state Assembly. In both houses, the Republican members have been very unified. I think represent the position that John talked about among some of the convention goers he's been talking with in Minnesota. And it really comes down to the tax increase or lack thereof that's needed to balance the budget. And California is the only state in the country that has both a two-thirds requirement for passing a budget and a two-thirds vote requirement for any state tax increase. There are three states altogether that have that requirement on the budget side, 11 on the tax side, but the intersection of the two is only California. And I think there probably is broad agreement on a spending plan, but the problem is that somewhere, depending on how deep you cut health care, how deeply you cut education, somewhere between $4 and $6 to $7 billion of new revenues, tax dollars, are needed to balance the budget, and that really is what the debate comes down to.
Do we know at this point, Jean, about Medi-Cal?
Until we know how much money will come into the state budget next year, I think no single program is out of the woods. Or nobody who depends on a program, nobody who gets their income, in the case of a health care provider, really knows how much money they'll have. In terms of Medi-Cal, the state and federally supported health care program for low-income Californians, that one's particularly complex because the court's involved. Back in February, the legislature did pass a cut in payments to health care providers. However, the courts have said that that cut was made inappropriately. The legislature wants to restore some of that cut, and the date at which that restoration would be made is still up in the air, depending on how much in savings they want to squeeze out. And the courts have blocked the cut from taking effect. So here is a good example of really almost complete chaos in a very large program where healthcare providers of services don't know what they can expect once the budget's signed.
Jean Ross, again, is with us from Sacramento. She's executive director of the California Budget Project. And I should mention that students are worried that they might not receive promised Cal Grant checks this month. The grant is $1,551. It's a check that goes to pay any graduating high school senior who meets the financial criteria and has a minimum 2.0 grade point average. It could have an impact on, well, about 86,000 community college students. And Scott Lay is president and CEO of Community College League of California. Scott, good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Those numbers I gave out just now, I mean, what's your sense of how they're going to be, well, what the overall impact is going to be?
Well, I think California's community colleges and the students we serve are in critical condition because of this budget impasse. You mentioned these needy students. They have an average income of $16,000 a year. And so they're counting on these Cal grants to buy their textbooks, to provide transportation. And at a time when California's economy is really struggling and people are turning back to community colleges for retraining, there is now this significant gap in the availability of that education caused by Sacramento.
What are you doing as far as girding your loins in preparation for the fact that this money may not be there?
Well, some colleges have found ways to cover for this for the missing Cal grants. We have three priorities in this situation. We're protecting students, protecting employees, and trying to protect small businesses that are vendors for the colleges. But we can only go so far. Colleges have a responsibility to meet payroll on a monthly basis, even though the money's not coming from the state. And so some colleges are able to cover for the missing Cal grants. Others are doing whatever they can to ensure students continue to have access. But in the end, they have to basically put their necks out on the line, hoping that Sacramento is going to come through with money in the next 30 to 60 days.
So you're just sitting on pins and needles here, huh?
Absolutely. Community colleges have $940 million has not been provided already that should have been provided. And as Jean was talking about, another large payment of about $460 million is supposed to be paid later on in September. The colleges are running out of cash and very quickly. And unfortunately, unlike previous years, the private markets don't have capital to lend the colleges. So some of the solutions we've used to get through these impasses in the past just aren't available this year.
Well, plus it's been running longer than it ever has. I mean, we've broken a record in terms of days of an impasse here.
Absolutely. I'm going on my honeymoon this weekend, and never did I envision that we wouldn't have a budget in September. I think we're all caught by surprise, yet in a similar vein, we don't want to push through a bad budget. That's what we were talking about yesterday in the committee hearing on the Republican plan, which, while would provide community colleges the same amount this year as the governor proposes, would cut $350 million from community colleges next year from the governor's proposal. So we don't want to see a quick and bad budget, but students and our vendors and our employees are starting to feel the pain.
Well, congratulations on your recent nuptials, and try to enjoy your honeymoon in spite of all this.
Thanks so much, Michael.
That's Scott Lay, who's president and CEO of the Community College League of California. Mary Ignatius is also joining us this morning. She's statewide organizer for Parent Voices. They're a San Francisco-based grassroots organization that advocates for increased child care resources for low-income families. Good morning, Mary Ignatius.
Good morning.
Tell me how this is having its impact on you.
Well, it's having an impact on anyone who serves childcare for families who receive childcare subsidies, and for, as Jean was mentioning, a lot of the nonprofit agencies that are contracted to pay for these services have not been able to pay for these services since July 1st. Some agencies, because you know the state budget is delayed year after year, and some have prepared themselves by taking out loans and taking out lines of credit, but even those loans are depleting. And so a lot more agencies come this month will not be able to pay for services.
So, and excuse me, if we don't have a budget, let's say by the end of September, what would that mean for these agencies?
I mean, we're talking about not being able to pay family child care providers, child care centers and homes. They would not be able to pay their own staff. I mean, it has a tremendous impact on these nonprofit agencies.
Already having an impact, though, as we can measure it?
Already having an impact. I mean, some agencies have taken out of line of credit, and if they spend their entire line of credit, for instance, one of the largest agencies in Los Angeles is Crystal Stairs. They've taken out $15 million in a line of credit to continue to pay for services. If they use the entire $15 million, they will pay $180,000 in interest out of their own pocket. That doesn't get reimbursed when the state budget gets signed.
I'm reading that some child care programs in Berkeley and Oakland haven't been paid since July.
That's right. We have a program called Centro Bahia, Woodstock. There's several family child care homes. I mean, they're staying open by tooth and nail. I mean, they're scrambling to be able to keep their doors open. But if this continues, they're going to have to make some really hard decisions. And these are our children who will definitely be impacted.
Mary Ignatius, again, a statewide organizer of Parents Voices. Parent Voices is a San Francisco-based grassroots organization that advocates for increased child care resources for low-income families. And let me go back to Jean Ross, who's with us from Sacramento, executive director of the California Budget Project. Jean, there really are fewer places in the budget to cut. I mean, that's one of the things that we're sort of staring in the face here in terms of all these cuts and their impact.
And that's part of the legacy of repeated budget crises in California. We've been facing red ink in the state budget since 2001. And I think part of this governor's legacy is that he has used the ballot box. That's a tool he came into office saying he planned to use. And in the early years, when he first took office, he did propose things, got the legislature's agreement to borrow some transportation funds, for example, to borrow some money, move money around between the state and local governments and schools in a way that helped out the state budget. He then went to the voters to say, never again. In essence, let me borrow this money in the case of some transportation dollars for 2 years, and then we'll go to the ballot and lock down that money constitutionally so it can't be used again. Well, the again is now. And so some of those solutions, as people call them in Sacramento, that were used earlier in the decade, were used in the last decade to balance budgets, can't be done or are much more costly to do now than in prior years. So we really are, and this is a little bit of a simplification, but we're down pretty much to where you either need to cut or to tax. There is some borrowing at all of the different proposals on the table, but there are fewer options, and the choices are much tougher in terms of how do we balance the budget. And that's why I say that it really comes down to, are you willing to raise taxes in order to avert cuts that there really is no support for in education, in health care programs to seniors and others.
We're coming up on a break. I want to give out our phone number. You can join us to talk about this budget impasse. Is it having an impact on you? Do you anticipate that it will? And to what extent are you concerned? Give us a call. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The California state budget is now 66 days overdue and counting. That's the latest budget in California history. And in this hour, we're looking at what programs and services are being hurt by this long budget impasse. And certainly you listeners who are with us this morning are welcome to join us and talk about your own concerns and apprehensions, or particularly if you've already felt the effect of this budget stalemate, we'd like to hear from you. You may have questions or comments in general about the budget. Our phone line number, which again is toll-free, is 866-733-6786, or you can always send us an email, and the email address is forum@kqed.org. Scott Lay joined us earlier, President and CEO of Community College League of California, and we have Gene Ross on the line, Executive Director of the California Budget Project, and talked also to Mary Ignatius, who is statewide organizer of Parent Voices, a San Francisco-based grassroots organization advocating for increased child care resources for low-income families. And Mary Ignatius, just a quick question to you before I go to our callers, and that is the child care service providers that you mentioned that did not really prepare for this in the way that some have, given the past track record on budget impasses. At this point, what can we say about just how shaky or how tenuous things are for them?
Well, they're really teetering on the edge. I mean, the funding they depend on keeps their doors open. It pays for their rent. It pays for their staff. It pays for food for the children. And so, you know, we don't know when exactly is their last straw where they have to close, but we just know that this isn't the way to support small businesses and keep businesses open in California by putting them under this tremendous pressure.
Mary, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Again, that's Mary Ignatius of Parent Voices. And again, I'd like to hear from listeners in terms of your concerns and your apprehensions, and if this is already affecting you, how is it affecting you? But it continues to drag on, and some of you are going to be affected, perhaps if you're not already. So you may want to simply let us know how you're experiencing this personally. Or again, if you have questions or comments, you can email them to us, forum@kqed.org, or join us by phone at 866-733-6786. And let's go to your calls. Betsy, good morning.
Good morning. I'm the elderly mother of an adult with severe developmental disabilities. She is mentally retarded, physically handicapped. I am extremely worried because the group homes and the providers of daycare programs for the developmentally disabled, some of them have already gone through lines of credit. Others of them can't get lines of credit. They have received no money from the state, and they are now beginning to suggest that they will have to go out of business. What will happen to our children and adults?
Gene Ross, yes. Some thoughts from you on this, yeah.
I think that's one of the themes, and I think Mary talked about this and Scott talked about this a little earlier, that makes this year different, other than the fact that it's gone longer than any other year in history, is the credit crunch, which is linked to what's happened in the housing market. And so revolving loans, which are expensive, and the small businesses, nonprofit agencies that take them out don't get reimbursed for the interest costs they would pay, are harder or non-existent to get. And a lot of times facilities such as family child care programs, the group home that the group homes that the caller just spoke about, have used things like home equity lines on their personal residences to get them through past budget crises. They may not be able, they probably are not able to do that this year. And the programs such as foster care facilities, programs for the developmentally disabled, some of the senior programs, respite care programs or the like, really are the ones that are most hard hit by this stalemate because they have very thin operating margins, and most of the time, most of their money comes from publicly supported programs.
Good luck to you, Betsy. We'll wish you well, and thank you for calling, and we'll get some more of our callers on here. Joseph, good morning.
Yeah, you know, what I want to say is that it's absurd for the legislature to have a 75% majority to be able to pass a budget.
Forgive me, Joseph, it's two-thirds. That's 66. And,
it's two-thirds?
Yeah, it's two-thirds.
Well, it's too high because it gives too much power to the minority. 55%, that's agreeable.
Well, that's been the problem all along. Senator Daryl Steinberg was on with us yesterday, and he's now head of the state Senate, and he said he's going to see to it that this goes to the people and that the people will indeed, he feels, respond and bring about a change. Yeah, sorry.
Governor, the governor should get behind this because that would be the only way the Republicans are going to be in agreement if they see that this little power they have is taken away from them.
Well, I thank you for the call. Politically, of course, the Republicans don't want that power taken away from them. It's a hammer. It's like a veto. And I suppose it's safe to say, Gene Ross, that Governor Schwarzenegger, well, you know, he's a team player in that sense. He suggested a kind of tax, but at the same time, he's been one of these no-tax governors to please his own party.
The tax that would go away as soon as he left office, and I think that, you know, maybe that sounds cynical, but that is the fact that he proposed a temporary sales tax, even though his own forecast or the forecast of his appointees show that that tax would go away while the state is still in deep financial difficulties. We have red ink in California as far as the eye can see. The governor proposed a number of temporary measures that would go away as soon as the next governor gets sworn into office. He and the Republicans in the legislature and the Democrats have shown some willingness to go along with this, are proposing to borrow against future lottery payments and in order to pay back those loans, they'd encourage more Californians to gamble away more of their income. I think that's a risky proposition and probably not the best public policy while Californians are having a hard time putting food on their table and gas in their cars.
Gina, it behooves me to ask you because I know there's going to be listener response to this from time to time, and you're kind of our quarterback here this hour on the budget, and you always give expert analysis, but there are those who consider the California Budget Project left-leaning. Is that an accurate way to describe it?
I think we are fiscally prudent. We look at how the budget affects low and middle-income Californians. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, get most of our money from foundations. I think we have a good knack of questioning what both sides do, and I would say the lottery proposal is a good example of that. That is something that, again, the Democrats in the Assembly have bought into. Senator Parada's compromise plan that came out at the end of last week would have bought into that. We have probably been the most vocal critics of borrowing against future lottery payments in California, which finds something to irritate everybody.
On we go to John. Welcome.
Yes, good morning, Michael, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
As a longtime political observer here in San Francisco, to me, this budget delay is a major embarrassment to the state, among other things. But I think it clearly should clearly demonstrate to the voters the compelling necessity of reapportionment reform. Because if you had a competitive district, state senate, state assembly, you would produce, first of all, districts where an incumbent could be challenged effectively, but it would produce politicians that are pragmatists. And I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about, pragmatism. Back in 1967, when Ronald Reagan first started being governor, there was a fiscal crisis in the state. The big problem then was money flow. It didn't come in consistently. We did not have state withholding of taxes at that time. And it was minority leader Robert Monaghan of Tracy, Republican, who came up with the idea of payroll withholding. You also had pragmatic Republicans like John Veneman, Stanislaus County, and you have Bill Bagley up in Marin County. They were pragmatists. In other words, they were not ideologues. They believed in negotiating solutions, and it was a combination of tax increases and deep spending cuts that balanced the budget at that time. Pete Wilson had to do something similar in 1991. We need competitive districts at the state assembly and the state senate, and you would produce pragmatic politicians who knew that if they didn't do the state's business in a proper fashion, they could be challenged either in a primary or in a general election.
John, I appreciate the historical perspective. I don't know that reapportionment will necessarily bring more pragmatism, but it certainly will bring changes. Here's a listener who is at Cabrillo College who writes, "Thank you for addressing the state budget this morning. I'm a clerical worker at a community college. My previous job was at a nonprofit school for homeless children. When that job ended, I chose to work at a community college because it seemed a logical next step. What other institution so powerfully offers a chance to anyone and everyone to pursue the goals of higher education, whether their interest is a transfer to a university, an occupational degree or certificate, or personal enrichment? The cost to this state of underfunding our community colleges cannot be overstated. This would be false economy of the highest order. In our need to balance our state budget, it is important to be sure that our two-year colleges are able to fulfill the contribution that they promise our communities. And let me go to more of your calls, and we go to Mickey. Morning, Mickey.
Hi, I'm calling from San Francisco. I'm a pharmacist here specializing in HIV care. And I think that the people that are most at risk are often people that don't even understand that there's something going on like this. As a healthcare provider, we've taken these budget cuts basically on good faith that the government would turn around and do the right thing. But since the 10% cuts went into effect, we were losing upwards of $50 for every prescription, HIV prescription, being filled. And a person on multiple drugs like HIV patients are, that's hundreds of dollars every single month. And the proposed 5% cut rather than the 10% that they're proposing, I'm still losing $2 to $3 every single prescription. And when you're dispensing thousands of dollars of prescriptions every single month, you can't afford to do that. You'd make more money just putting it in a CD at 3% interest.
There's an impact, Gene Ross, from one of our listeners we hadn't perhaps considered here.
One of the factors the court took into account when saying that the cuts that the legislature did pass earlier this year were inappropriately made, that they didn't do their research, that they were perhaps cutting rates below the break-even point for many of those providers. And what's happening around the state is we have a lot of Californians who might have a Medi-Cal card that entitles them to health coverage, but they can't get it because doctors, hospitals, pharmacists are just saying, we're not covering our cost, much less making any money on the deal. And healthcare access in California has become diminished. We pay less for each of the people enrolled in the Medi-Cal program than virtually any other state in the country. Rarely is California at the bottom in terms of what we spend compared to other states, but in the Medi-Cal program, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, we are. We've chosen to cover relatively more people, but not to pay the health care providers that take care of those people adequately for the services they deliver.
Gene Ross, again, is Executive Director of the California Budget Project, and we move on to more callers. Eric from San Jose, good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
Okay.
My question is, first of all, is there a way in which we can actually balance the budget, meaning can we spend the money that's actually being brought in rather than spending future money? The next question I would have in follow-up to that is, why are these agencies that are receiving the money, meaning these small nonprofits, not running their business in a matter that's in a matter that allows them to use the money that comes in rather than, you know, after 3 months of running without cash flow from the state, why are they unable to continue operating their business? I actually run a small business myself, and I don't seem to have problems with cash flow in that same manner. Now, of course, I'm not getting funding from the state, but, you know, it's a pretty simple thing. This is whatever money comes in is what you spend. It's how you balance your household budget. If you don't have that money, you certainly don't have the ability to spend it.
Appreciate your questions, Eric. Gene Ross?
I'm sorry.
There's a $15 billion gap between the money that our state tax system would bring in for the year that began July 1 and the cost of providing the current level of programs and services. We are in a down economy, so all of the state's revenue sources are hit. More people are turning to the state because they're losing their job, losing their health coverage, having a tough time making ends meet. So that puts more demands on government. I think the pharmacist made probably the best point on this. Many times, the payments that those providers are receiving from public programs simply don't cover their costs. There are minimum wage laws. If you're a pharmacist, you have to pay the drug companies for the drugs that you then turn around and sell to your patients or give to your patients and get paid for by the state. Many small businesses do run on small margins, and I think, again, we have record level of debt for households. We always hear that government ought to run like a family. Well, most families in this country are carrying large credit card debt. So in California, government is running like a family, and we're deeply in debt.
And let me thank the caller and go to more of your emails here. Here's Tom, who writes, this letter is in defense of a two-third majority in order to pass a new budget. If not for this one rule, the GOP in California might as well not exist. I believe this to be the long-term goal of the left. The Dems are now in a position of perpetual majority vis-a-vis reapportionment and are now trying to solidify their iron grip on the state by essentially rendering the GOP irrelevant, since the GOP will no longer have a voice in this matter. If the GOP wins out, as you say, all Californians win. We'll have a budget without higher taxes. If the threshold is lower to 55% of Republicans like myself, we'll no longer have representation. Remember your history? Taxation without representation is a bad thing. I don't mind paying my fair share of taxes, but when so much of every tax dollar is just frittered away, I think giving more money to this behemoth is a bad idea. And here's Rick from Palo Alto, who says, I can't believe what I'm hearing. Borrowing against this and borrowing against that. Where does it stop? With bankruptcy of the state? Come on, cut spending and be responsible. Forget about changing the two-thirds vote to increase taxes. With this power, the state Senate would double all taxes each year for a decade until no one could live here except the non-paying, taxpaying half of the state. And we move on to some more of your emails. Colin from Alameda writes, it seems to me that the Republicans are adept at using supermajority procedural rules to obstruct the desires of the majority in the California legislature and in the U.S. Senate, and then blame the Democrats for lack of progress. I think that the Democrats need to be more vocal about blaming these problems on the obstructionist actions of the Republican minority. And, of course, we always, when we talk about the budget, well, get this kind of email. Any talk about reinstating the vehicle tax increase that Governor Schwarzenegger refunded when he took office? And the answer has always been no. That would almost be political suicide, even Democrats have said. But it does come up and will continue to come up. Question from Robert, who says, are state legislators receiving paid during the period that they have abdicated their budget responsibilities? They are not. Are they? Gene, at least, well, at this point, they are, but they won't be soon enough, right?
Let's see here. I'm looking. They are getting paid in the absence of a budget. They are not getting their per diem payments. However, they will get those once the budget is signed. Legislative staff, the governor's appointees, the high-level officials in the governor's administration, they are not getting their paychecks. They do get paid once the budget is signed.
And we go to Pristine in San Francisco. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
Hi.
Hi, I have a comment. I'm a third-year SF State student, and there were about 2,000 kids, at least locally here, who had registered on time, signed up for classes, and without warning, or at least for those of us who were not following what was going on with the California state budget, we got dropped from our classes, and we were told that the school was not going to be receiving any of our scholarship money. And it's like it's a huge hindrance on our part, especially for those of us who are about to graduate. I know about a handful of us who were rushing around to local community colleges or local, even other state colleges, trying to do last-minute admissions to try and get classes. And I know a few people who are at least 10 units away, 10 units from graduating or at least approaching their senior year. And counselors, several surrounding counselors have told us it's going to take us 2 years to get those 10 units, because not only are the programs at our schools super impacted, but teachers are quitting left and right. A friend of mine who graduated last year from SF State, the teacher said, you're getting out just in time because we're cutting funding, we're losing our best teachers, our best programs. And more importantly, as of last semester when I had classes and when I had health insurance, I got diagnosed for having a tumor on my back, and I have to wait 6 months because I couldn't get any classes. I didn't have the money for the scholarship, and we don't know what we're going to do about our health insurance, about our classes. This is our future, and I just feel like the politicians who, you know, ask the public to put them there to delegate and be in charge of things such as budget shouldn't ask us that if they cannot meet those expectations. These are people's lives. These are our futures, and, you know, our state labor force really depends on whether or not they can educate the youth of America. this completely ties into just like the problems that we're facing in our election.
Well, Pristine, and I appreciate very much your coming forward with not only your own circumstances, but your concern about the future, which you expressed quite passionately, and I thank you for that. And we'll get some more callers on while we have time, and we'll go next to Pleasant Hill. Debbie, good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. First, I would like to say that I'm just so blown away by Jean. She's so impressive. It's really hard to understand when you're not a direct service provider the intricacies, and she's done a fabulous job of understanding and expressing what's going on. I am an administrator in an adult day healthcare facility in Pleasant Hill. It's a nonprofit, small community-based organizations. We were hit July 1st with the 10% cuts, and then we're also now not receiving payment. I had to go to the community. I went to my grandma. I went to everybody begging for money so that we could keep our doors open because our board wanted to close us because that's the fiscally wise thing to do. Let me just say, first of all, to the caller who called about why can't we handle our cash flow issue, the state is what the body that determines our regulations as an adult day healthcare facility and our staffing. They're the ones who reimburse us our Medi-Cal rates, and they're the ones who are paying less than what it costs to provide the service. So it's not as simple as the caller made it sound. We are a very fiscally sound agency, and yet we run into this problem because it costs, Medi-Cal reimbursement doesn't cover two-thirds of the cost to provide the service, so I'm out doing fundraising all the time. Additionally, I want to say how short-sighted this budget 10% cut is, just based on the fact that to have somebody at an adult day healthcare facility costs taxpayers a quarter what it costs to have them in a nursing home. So if you continue to cut reimbursement rates, you continue to not pass a budget, you continue to have adult day healthcare centers close their doors, you're having folks in nursing homes at four times the cost.
Well, I thank you for those statistics and that analysis. And you want to comment, Jean Ross?
I'll say thank you for the kind words, and I think she explained the cash flow issues quite well.
And we'll get more of our callers on, and we'll go next to Matt in Oakland. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to echo the comments that you made that the legislative staff and the appointees are definitely not being paid. My wife works for the legislature, and there's been no pay since the budget crisis started. So it's not for lack of support. It's, you know, the members and their ideologies that really are standing in it. And I believe the members do get loans to cover their gaps. But, you know, it's not as if nobody in the legislature is feeling the effects. Everyone is feeling it at the Capitol.
Thank you for that, Matt. And Jean Ross, talk about the effects of this. How does this shape up in terms of the way the economy seems to be going? I mean, there's a lot of optimism coming from Governor Schwarzenegger about revenue that will flow in with perhaps the economy not going south.
I think we are now looking at a longer and potentially deeper economic downturn than many people initially forecast that could go certainly through the end of this year and maybe the better part of next year. That does have an impact on the revenues that come into the state. If people don't have the money to buy things, we're not collecting state sales tax. The downturn in the housing market has had a very significant impact on state and local government budgets. And because of the way Proposition 13 works, that impact will carry through until the houses that are now being sold at very low prices turn over at some point, hopefully for a higher value in the future. And again, if businesses cut back on health care for their employees, some of those employees end up turning to state programs for such as Medi-Cal for health care. So we're seeing less revenue on the one hand, more demand for services on the other hand. That's a recipe for a budget deficit. So certainly we're not, regardless of how this current crisis is resolved, we're not out of the woods, and many people believe that next year could be worse than this year. The year after will also be tough, particularly if tricks, gimmicks, and one-time solutions are used to balance this year's budget.
Has that been pretty much characteristic as you see things in the past?
We have pushed off our problems into the future. We borrowed $15 billion earlier this decade, the money the voters approved back in 2004. We've raided all the state's cookie jars. We've nipped and tucked a lot and pushed our problems off into the future. And sooner or later the future gets here, and I think that's what we're looking at now, really is the legacy of not confronting our fundamental budget problems in previous years.
Or maybe, as Andy Grove once said, the future is here. It's now.
The future is now, and unfortunately it'll also be here next year and the year after.
Well, you know, I guess it's a political question, but if you had to look in a crystal ball here, what would you say about when this thing can be resolved or to what extent it's going to carry on?
We are somewhat in the twilight zone, and I think all of our crystal balls are not functioning at this point in time. We certainly, I think many of us thought there would be a budget last weekend, which was the last weekend of the legislative session, and lawmakers were hard at work last weekend on the budget. It didn't happen. We hear days, we hear some, particularly on the Republican side of the aisle, saying it could be months before we see a budget. And again, it really comes down to how do you fill that $4 to $5 billion gap that everybody's agreed in broad scope on the magnitude of the cuts, but now it's how do we pay for what's left? And again, the budget plan the Republicans introduced on the weekend borrows, uses some accounting gimmicks to do that. Some of the borrowing, I think, is legally suspect. We are at a fundamental and vast disagreement over how to close that gap, and it doesn't look like it'll happen anytime soon.
Well, Jean Russ, appreciate your being with us, and thank you. Indeed, grateful for your expert analysis this morning. Jean Russ, again, is Executive Director of the California Budget Project. She was with us from Sacramento. We also spoke with Mary Ignatius, statewide organizer of Parent Voices, a San Francisco-based grassroots organization that advocates for increased child care resources for low-income families. And we checked in with Scott Lay, the president and CEO of the Community College League of California. We are coming up on another hour of Forum, and in the hour ahead, we're going to talk about architecture, and particularly the future of San Francisco with respect to architecture. Big Architecture and the City Festival kicking off this week. It's going to go on for a whole month, and we'll have some architects in here talking about how the city's going to look in the future and really how it looks now as well. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. We appreciate very much your listenership and remind you that you can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Forum Senior Editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell. Our interns, Joey Kahn, Shazia Joffrey, Kelly Pretzer, Megan Rollins, and Allison Van Dingelen. And our engineer is Danny Bringer. Executive Producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.